Welcome to Sustainable Voices. I'm your host, Thomas Walsh. Seeds for Change, Creatively Confronting the Energy Crisis, Part 1. The following presentation was recorded at the opening night of the Sustainable Living Festival. Held once a year in Melbourne, Victoria, the festival showcases various environmentally sound technologies, hosts numerous talks and discussions, and gives us an opportunity to come together and celebrate the joy of a sustainable lifestyle. Published in 1978, Seeds for Change was a book that described the energy crisis and its implications for Victoria and Australia many years before it entered the awareness of the general public. In fact, it has only been in the last 12 months or so that we have really started to see the idea of peak oil being discussed in mainstream media. The book offered a vision for Melbourne based on the idea of cluster and connect, that we cluster our communities near to our places of employment and our other activities in order to creatively respond to the increasing scarcity of cheap energy. In this presentation, the authors of the book Seeds for Change are reunited 27 years after the publication of their influential book for a retrospective on the 25 years that have passed since the book's publication. The authors discuss the oncoming energy crisis and its potentially disastrous consequences. They re-examine the book's central vision and explore its relevance to today. And finally, the authors talk about what has already been achieved and what remains to be done. Dr. Ian MacPhail, Victorian Minister for Environmental Sustainability, introduces the presentation.
The book Seeds for Change is in fact a book which contains both grand and sweeping views of what is required in terms of resource management, but it also concentrates on local and helpful processes and approaches for communities and individuals. It is grand in scale, swings between the global and the domestic, and it contains elaborate models all the way through to folksy suggestions as to how an individual might make a difference. So it's intellectual, it's sweeping, it's contextual, but it's also thoroughly practical. But the book that most of you have confessed to not having read, most of you have confessed, I suspect would confess they hadn't heard of it, came out at a time when there were a number of quite significant works of the sort occurring around the world. There was some may recall the Club of Rome, which provided a report on future population growth in the world. It was laughed out of court. The Meadows, Dana and Dennis Meadows, wrote The Limits of Growth. Highly perceptive, and when it came out in the 70s, it was laughed out of court. I suspect this book, when it came out, was seen as being very interesting, but what the blazes is it about? Why do we need it? And I think that was the question that needed to be asked then, but in fact, given a time of absolute massive technological change, massive growth in production around the world, a whole new world of consumer goods, it didn't seem real. So what happened to the seeds of change then? Did they fall on parched ground? And did they fail entirely to germinate? Or did they grow at least a few straggly weeds? Or in fact, did they hibernate and are now only just beginning to burst through the surface? I'm inclined to believe we've actually reached, it is more the final stage. We are now coming to accept, even if only at the top of our heads, that there is in fact a looming resource crisis. So maybe those seeds are beginning to come through the ground, and maybe those seeds will be of relevance to this generation, even if they didn't impact upon the generation for which it was written. Philip Sutton and I are in fact part of an international group that was founded by Dana and Dennis Meadows, the people who wrote The Limits of Growth, And in fact, there's been a highly intellectual discussion going on recently about can we decouple the concept of economic growth and the GDP from environmental degradation? Can we decouple resource exhaustion from growth? The only problem is, as it's gone on, it's become more and more complex. And indeed, with due respect to Philip, the first thing he does is reach for a model and leave him a decent-sized book, and there will be a decent-sized model by the time he's finished drawing it. And we'll come back to that in a moment, because it's not a commentary on model building, it's a commentary on how we get there. Today for me also was somewhat surreal. Being a commissioner for the environment is somewhat surreal anyway. But today was even more surreal because this morning I walked to a conference attended by the big end of town that was talking about the economic outlook and the political outlook for Australia. And to get there, I walked through all the tents that were being put up for the Sustainable Living Festival. I suspect I was a very small part of that group that walked to the meeting, which was next door in Zinc here, and to actually notice that there were tents with names that had some sort of environmental flavour to them or resource management flavour. In that conference, there was simply no recognition that there was a resource issue globally, except for two things. There is a recognition that oil prices are rising. And that's the problem. It's not that oil is peaking and oil is likely to be exhausted in the lifetime of our grandchildren. It was that the price was rising. And what did that mean for investment futures? The other was only a very brief mention that there was something called climate change that might be a risk to future investment. And that's as far as it went. There was no connection between what was happening out here in the open area of Federation Square and what was happening as the economists and the investors and the brokers spoke about their futures. So what questions can we ask for tonight, or I could ask for tonight? Is there the necessary urgency in the general community about the need to conserve resources and to manage waste and to exercise material stewardship? Is there that necessary urgency? Is there the necessary focus that can allow us to get through, create the pathways that can help decision makers come to conclusions on this topic? The great problem about complex situations, they lead to very complex suggested resolutions. And even though we joke about politicians, in reality, they cannot sell complexity to the community. They have to have clear pathways. Can we provide that for them? Is there the required belief in the community? A significant part of the community still believes climate change to be shonky science. They've been told that by shock jocks and opinion writers. It doesn't matter that those same people have changed their tune. It has left the impression that climate change is shonky science and is being peddled by that usual group of suspects, those lefty intellectual academics. There are those who do not see or can understand how resources may be running out. I even heard a very senior member, not a politician, a very senior member of a central department of government who said the availability of water is not a problem. It's only a problem of allocation. And then we also believe in the community that if there is a crisis, big head technology will make it right. Somebody will come up with the new inventions of vehicle fuels, will come up with the new inventions in relation to emissions, geosequestration, all of those words. So the big hit will save the day. And then, of course, lastly, will we only as a species, react to crisis? Will we only bring the massive resources of our industrial and social and cultural machine into action if there is a general crisis? My grandsons may well live in a post-hydrocarbon age. I'll be happily dead. Why do I have to worry about it? What is? And they, I'm certain, will combine with all the power of the human species and save the world with new technology. So will we only react then in terms of the crisis?
Philip Sutton, the President of the Sustainable Living Foundation and the Director of Green Innovations, is the first of the book's authors that we are going to hear from. He gives us a brief summary of the book's main concepts and then shares with us what he gained from the experience.
At least a fair bit of the book can be summed up with three words, cluster and connect. I don't know whether that resonates with anybody, but... and convivial community. Maurie Crowe was the convener of the group. You've probably heard us mentioning him. Anyway, he at that stage, this was, 1976 we started, and then 77 we were in full swing, and then the book came out in 78. So anyway, in those days, none in 70s, whatever. Murray was an old guy, but grey haired and all the rest of it. But the thing was, he had this absolutely masterful art of being able to summarise things. So create a convivial community and cluster and connect, really pull together, if you like, the social and the physical aspects of what we were recommending. The first part of the book looks at the energy crisis, the problem that we're in, and we'll come to that a bit later. But it was sufficiently... We could see already that with the OPEC oil crisis that it was having serious impact at the time. And in fact, after our book came out, it got even worse with the 1979 increases in prices. So that was in our minds. What we then tried to do over a year, we met every... I will answer the question. We met every Friday night for a year. And
never mind, keep going.
Thursday, whatever. Shifted to Friday in my brain. Anyway, we met once a week. Let's get a consensus here. We met once a week for a year. And what we were trying to do is work out how on earth could you physically and socially change the structure we had so that you could actually live in an energy frugal world. And the cluster and connect idea was that we could already see the trends that were emerging as the dominance of cars penetrated our whole physical fabric of the city. People would find cheap land to do this, to do that, and things would be scattered all over the place. So if you wanted to go to a childcare centre, it would be down in this street. If you wanted to go to the health centre, it would be some other street. If you wanted to go to the bank, it would be somewhere else. And so even our little sort of strip shopping centres were getting dispersed all over the place. And so it became, it was more and more essential, if you like, or more convenient for people to have to use a car, because how on earth were you going to get to all these places if you didn't have one? And so, of course, that became a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we could already see that happening, and of course it's continued largely unabated since then. So cluster and connect. Bring the destinations together so that you don't actually have to have a car in order to get to plenty of places. Clustering social activities, clustering business activities, clustering living, getting a multi-purpose city with all sorts of activities close together. One of the values for being involved with the Seeds for Change project for me was, most of the rest of us, I mean, I was pretty well fresh out of university, a couple of years out, but what it did for me is it gave me a very strong, visceral, gut-level feeling that a better way of organising our city was actually possible. One of the guiding philosophies behind what we were developing through that vision-building process was we were trying to come up with something which conformed to the laws of physics and chemistry and biology. You didn't have water running uphill, and it wasn't wishful thinking. It had to be grounded in really stuff that could physically happen. It also had to be grounded in real people, not imagining some sort of brand new, sort of brave new world of people, who are all ideologically sound. It had to be real people who lived in Melbourne. In fact, when I wrote my first chapter, Murray sort of read it and said, "That's very nice, Philip," and then said, "But it actually doesn't sound like it's written about anywhere on the planet. It doesn't feel like it's connected to Melbourne." So I actually was told to go away and rewrite it so it was connected to this city that we're right in. So we had to make sure it was really working. And the result of spending that time arguing with each other, as you could probably imagine we might have done, and kicking around issues, it really meant that at the end of a year, we had this very, very strong feeling, or at least certainly I did, I don't know about anybody else, but a very strong feeling this alternative was not just pie in the sky nonsense. It wasn't just dreaming. It was something that was a physical, tangible thing. And we had it so solid in our head that, you could go out and do it. If you go to Box Hill, you'll find a rather poor rendition of some of the ideas that we actually put forward in the book. I think with the Board of Works and a few other organisations, actually took up some of the some echoes of what we were putting forward in the book, and it was translated into the integrated public and private transport hub at Box Hill. So there was that sense of physicality about how you could make it happen, that it would happen with real people.
Chris Martin, now retired from the CSIRO, talks about his personal experience of the oil shocks whilst living in Japan.
In the early 1970s, I lived in Japan, and I personally experienced the 1973 oil crisis in a country that didn't have any oil. And I experienced the sheer panic of people who suddenly realised that there was no oil, that the ships had all been diverted to the United States so that there was no oil coming to Japan. They didn't have any oil of their own, and there was absolute panic. The panic was with good reason too, because not only did it affect transport, but a lot of the electricity was generated from oil. And one of the first things that happened after the crisis started was that supermarkets started to empty, because people were hoarding goods. A lot of stuff was not being delivered because it couldn't get there, and the industries were starting to close down, and it was quite amazing to see. But rather than cars queuing at petrol stations, the main thing that I noticed was that people were queuing in the snow to get a can of kerosene to heat their room, because in Japan at that time they didn't have central heating. And they mostly lived in small flats with a kerosene heater in the middle, so that without kerosene they'd be very cold indeed. But people were actually lining up in the snow to get a can of kerosene, and that left a quite deep impression on me. So after I came back from Japan, I started working at CSIRO, and I also then came into contact with Maurie Crowe, who had established this group called Conservation of Urban Energy at the Conservation Council, or what's now Environment Victoria. And having experienced just very directly what the effects of an oil crisis could be, we wondered how Australia could be changed so that in future, if such a situation were to occur here, that we could cope much better with such a crisis and not have the sort of panic that occurred in Japan. But I just wonder whether we can do that, because the government at the moment seems to be doing all the wrong things, and they're not getting ready for such a situation at all.
Deborah White talks about her contribution to the book and gives us some insight into the ideas that influenced it.
One of the reasons I was involved in energy at all, and then when I met Maurie and he said, would you be interested in joining this group, because we want to see what we can do about making Melbourne work socially and energy-wise, ecologically, culturally. The reason I'd been involved with energy already was, firstly, that my father actually was chairman of the State Electricity Commission way back when there was one. He died last year, and he died a broken-hearted man. I feel quite emotional. Imagine getting emotional about the State Electricity Commission. But when they sold it, he was devastated. He had started working towards environmentally responsible approach to the supply of electricity. And, of course, selling the SEC, sold all that down the hill. He was also involved in the Snowy Mountains scheme, and they're going to sell that too. So, Dad, I'm sorry. Couldn't stop him. So I spent my holidays in power stations and in Tasmania and in Victoria and in New South Wales and got quite interested in that. When I became an architect, then I was asked to come back when I had a baby and I needed a job, and architects' offices aren't very good with babies, and universities were better. They're not anymore. And so I needed a part-time job, and they asked me would I come and do some work on energy, because I seemed to know a bit about science as well, more than most architects. I went down to the CSIRO, did some work there, and ended up being involved very much in teaching energy-efficient house design to students in Melbourne. I now have been doing that in Adelaide for the last 25 years. So energy was sort of part of my upbringing from a particularly strange point of view, and my father ended up a very deep greenie by the time he died at the age of 90. God, I can't talk about him. At the age of 94. I travelled around the world a bit and saw how people didn't need lots of money and they didn't need the Melbourne suburbs to be happy. And that came back to me sometime later when I was rung up. I'd got involved in permaculture. You see, I'm one of those radical lefty, greeny, feminist, lefty, academic people. But I'm really interested in how that can be made real. And when I went around the world teaching through places like Southeast Asia, I saw Cambodia before, I saw Vietnam before, I saw Afghanistan before, and it all feels a bit awful, and I'm very sorry for those of you who aren't old enough to have done all of that. Being young must be really ghastly. I was rung up by a man who, he rang me and he said, would you be liking to be coming to Nepal? We would like you to be helping us with permaculture. And I happened to be going to Italy, and so I changed the ticket and flew via Kathmandu and worked in Nepal, where I learned more from them than they learned from me. That makes me emotional too, because Nepal is in... I wear my politics on my sleeve. Nepal is now in real trouble and I don't work there anymore, but for 10 years I used to work there, fostered a daughter who now is going to be a policewoman in New South Wales, a little Nepali girl this tall. Meanwhile, I was being an activist as well, and because that's when I met Winsome in the North Melbourne Association, for instance. I was an honorary member. I lived in South Melbourne, but anyway. And we got involved in community childcare because we all had small kids and there wasn't any subsidized childcare. So all of this sort of thing seemed to come together, and the personal, the political, the professional, the practical, the physical were all melded together the way we used to think it was. Money seems to have taken over, but not nearly so much in Adelaide. So when I come back to Melbourne, I discover the real world again. I escaped straight after Seeds for Change. I escaped to Adelaide, where I can actually run my life with a solar house, rainwater and a bicycle and a permaculture garden. So I'm sorry for you lot. I'm back here to visit my 92-year-old mum. I'm naturally frugal, I think partly because of my parents living through the Depression. And so my philosophy, and I think it is a good philosophy for everybody, in particular when you're dealing with what you can do for yourself, frugal hedonism. You've got to be frugal, because if everybody did what some people around, I don't mean us, of course, but what, if everybody behaved like the rich people with those Tuscan houses do, the world would be dead. And whenever I do anything, I think, how would it be if everybody did this? But of course, if there wasn't any hedonism, why be alive at all? You can live in an air-conditioned house and turn the switches on, and you can never go out because you can do everything on the internet, and you might as well be dead. So frugal hedonism is the way to go, and it seems to me that cities and houses could be very much better if that's the way we thought. So frugal hedonism at home, and then frugal hedonism in the neighbourhood, and then frugal hedonism in the city. And I didn't think I was going to say those sorts of things, but that will do.
Alan Pears, now a professor at RMIT, describes his contribution to the book and talks about some of the things that are already happening.
I saw myself as an apprentice in this process. I was in my mid-20s by the time we got involved with Seeds for Change, and I had done an engineering degree, and by the end of it decided I didn't want to be an engineer. So then I'd done a dip ed and taught for a couple of years, and then decided that schools were too conservative. So then I worked in the community development and alternative education area. And in fact, I came to Seeds for Change because Maurie Crowe came in to see me when I was working at a place called the Learning Exchange. and said, we need someone to write this chapter called The Seeds Are There, where you actually talk about the kinds of things that are already happening around Melbourne that are models that show that what we're talking about is not just a lovely theory, it's all real-world stuff. So in that sense, I came from quite a specialist direction, I guess, although I had had quite an interest in alternative energy and issues such as that. And in fact, the 70s were quite an amazing time in that sense, because as Chris said, there was a lot of discussion about oil crises and renewable energy and things like that. At the same time, from a community perspective, there were very exciting things happening. I had the privilege of being involved with one of the Whitlam government's Australian Assistance Plan programs, where they essentially set up community-based grassroots organisations with funding of, I think, $1 million a year for each region, to foster community. And we had a great time giving community groups just enough money to lubricate their activities, and we just watched lots of things expand in the 70s. So that was very much my experience coming into the book. I guess I got sucked in again because, having worked in a lot of community groups, I actually found a lot of guilt and a lot of, I worked more hours than you did this week for nothing, and things like that happening. And for me, the experience of working with Murray and Ruth Crowe and the team of people here, where there was a real sense of caring about the people involved. So if someone had issues or problems, there was always time to spend with the people, even though we were trying to do this really ambitious process. So from my point of view, it wasn't just the content of this book that was incredibly valuable. I learnt a lot about how to run a really ambitious process in a way that nurtured and looked after the people that were part of it. So that was where I saw it. I guess just to finish up, I ended up co-writing several chapters and editing half of the book and trying to get it published before the Conservation Council got too angry with us for falling very long way behind the deadline. But we did it all.
That was the first half of the presentation, Seeds of Change, Creatively Responding to the Energy Crisis. To find out more about this show, to join the discussions on the forum, or to receive updates on upcoming shows, go to sv.baximus.com. Thanks for listening.